We completed discussion of Abraham yesterday, so we move ahead this afternoon to capital E, which is Isaac, page 4 of your outline. I'm not going to discuss Isaac at any great length, just a few comments. Notice there are 7 subheads there, first of which is his birth. Genesis 18 and Genesis 21. Actually, that should be 17 and 18 and 21, because the birth is promised in Genesis 17. Verse 19, God said, Sarah thy wife shall bear thee a son indeed, and thou shalt call his name Isaac. And I will establish my covenant with him for an everlasting covenant and with his seed after him. And then over in chapter 18, you have the repetition of that. We looked at this in connection with our discussion of Abraham. But verse 10 and 18 says, I will certainly return unto thee according to the time of life, and lo, Sarah thy wife shall have a son. And Sarah laughs, you read in verse 12. But you read in 14, is anything too hard for the Lord? At the time appointed, I will return unto thee according to the time of life, and Sarah shall have a son. The birth then is described in chapter 21, where you read in the first verse, the Lord visited Sarah as he had said, and the Lord did unto Sarah as he had spoken. For Sarah conceived and bore Abraham a son in his old age at the set time of which God had spoken to him. You read in verse 5, Abraham was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born to him. We know that Sarah was 10 years younger than Abraham, so she was 90. Yes.
Is there any difference in the word used for Abraham's last and Sarah's last? So is it the context of the brothers that they laughed differently and therefore different reactions from your
mom? Now, in 18:12, it says Sarah laughed, and where is the other one? I'm not sure.
Seventeen.
Oh, yes. I doubt if there's any difference. Is there a reason why you think there might have been?
Because God seems to have responded differently than he wasn't angry with Abraham and his mom, and he appears to be angry with Sarah and his mom.
Well, perhaps you could explain that in that in 17 already, when Abraham laughs, God says in 19 that Sarah is going to bear a son, you know, within the year. And then that promise doesn't seem to be enough, because you come to chapter 18 and Sarah still doesn't believe it. I don't know if that's an explanation that's possible. So that then the Lord says in verse 13 of 18, wherefore did Sarah laugh, saying, shall I have surely bear a child? Is anything too hard for me? And then really in 14, he really repeats what he said in verse 21 of chapter 17. Because 21 of 17 is, at this set time within the next year, you're going to have a child. And he says that in 14. So maybe it's just the need to reassert what he's already said.
All right, 2 on your sheet is Isaac's being offered, which is Genesis 22. We discussed that chapter as the high point of Abraham's faith. And I'm not going to go back and discuss the chapter again. It's certainly a significant event in the life of Isaac. Thirdly, his marriage, Genesis 24. I discussed that yesterday, sort of indirectly, when we looked at this whole business of redemptive historical versus illustrative kind of use of some of these historical historical passages in the Old Testament. But just a couple comments on 24. I think we see that Isaac is passive. Marriage is arranged for him by his father through the servant. And even beyond that, the servant asks for a sign, and the Lord really designates the woman that is to be the wife for Isaac. But the marriage is important because it's to be through Isaac and his wife then, Rebekah, that the line of promise is to continue. So Rebekah, the daughter of Bethuel, Abraham's nephew, is shown to be the servant, or shown to the servant to be the one that is to be Isaac's wife. And she willingly agrees to come and back with the servant. And she and Isaac are married. Just for this relationship, running again later, you see that Terah is the ancestor, and then Abraham and Nahor, who marries Milcah. Bethuel is the son of Nahor and Milcah, and Rebekah is the daughter of Bethuel. And so in the line from Abraham here, Isaac marries Rebekah. Now, 4 on your sheet is his sons, that is, the sons of Isaac. Genesis 25, 19 and following. Genesis 25, 19 is one of those structural divisions in the book of Genesis. You read, these are the generations of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham begot Isaac. Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah as his wife, the daughter of Bethuel, the Syrian of Padan Aram, the sister to Laban the Syrian. And Isaac entreated the Lord for his wife because she was barren. And the Lord was entreated by him, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. And the children struggled together within her, and she said, if it be so, why am I thus? And she went to inquire of the Lord. And the Lord said unto her, two nations are in thy womb, and two manner of people shall be born of thee, and the one people shall be stronger than the other people, and the elder shall serve the younger. And when her days to be delivered were fulfilled, behold, there were twins in her womb. The first came out red all over like a hairy garment. They called his name Esau, and after came his brother out, and his hand took hold on Esau's heel. His name was called Jacob. And Isaac was 80 years old when she bore them. The thing to notice here again is that for 20 years, Rebekah was barren. You see, in verse 20, it says Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah as his wife. But when Jacob and Esau are born, she was 80 years old. So for 20 years, she was barren. And I think, again, we can say the promised seed does not come in the course of ordinary natural processes, but by God's special intervention. Because you read in verse 21, Isaac entreated the Lord for his wife because she was barren. And the Lord was entreated by him, and Rebekah's wife conceived. So Isaac prays, the Lord answers. And then Rebekah is told that she has two children in her womb who will become two nations. And perhaps even more significantly, that the elder will serve the younger. Question.
Just a second here about the marriage. Excuse me, Rebekah. Are we to take it significant that it just so happened that Rebekah happened to be the family of Abraham? Some relations with Abraham. I mean, when the servant went, wasn't he aware that Abraham had family in that town?
Oh, yes, certainly.
And wasn't he looking for that family?
Yeah. In fact, that's the reason when Abraham says, in verse 3 of 24, to his servant, I will make thee swear by the Lord, the God of heaven, and the God of the earth, that thou shalt not take a wife unto my son of the daughters of the Canaanites, among whom I dwell, but thou shalt go unto my country, to my kindred, and take a wife unto my son Isaac. So, you know, that was the purpose of him going there, that he would find a wife.
So the well incident must have really was basically to find out which
that's
part
right.
of the family.
That's right.
He wasn't like going to some any old well and saying, okay.
No. Right. No.
Okay.
I think it's within that context. Because when he arrives, he says in verse 14, let it come to pass that the damsel to whom I shall say, let down thy pitcher, and I pray thee I may drink. And she shall say, drink, and I will give thy camels also. Let her be the one whom thou hast appointed for thy servant Isaac. And thereby shall I know that thou hast shown kindness unto me. And
there's nothing there about her being part of Abraham's family.
No.
I would assume then that only Abraham's family can come to that well.
Oh, well, that's hard to say. He must have arrived at the place where Abraham's family was accustomed to draw the water, I would think.
Yeah.
Yeah. But beyond that, I don't think the narrative throws much light on it. Okay, number five is the covenant is reaffirmed to Isaac. Genesis 26, verses 1 to 5. There was a famine in the land, beside the first famine that was in the days of Abraham, and Isaac went unto Abimelech, king of the Philistines, unto Gerar. And the Lord appeared unto him and said, go not down into Egypt, dwell in the land which I shall tell thee of, sojourn in this land, and I will be with thee and will bless thee. For unto thee, and here you get the repetition of the Abrahamic promises, unto thee and unto thy seed, I will give all these countries, I will perform the oath which I swore unto Abraham thy father, and I will make thy seed to multiply as the stars of the heaven, and will give unto thy seed all these countries, and in thy seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed. So the covenant promises are reaffirmed to Isaac. Down in verse 24 of the same chapter, you read, the Lord appeared unto him the same night and said, I am the God of Abraham, thy father. Fear not, I am with thee and will bless thee and will multiply thy seed for my servant Abraham's sake. So you see, we're moving forward with this line of promise as it is confirmed then to Isaac. Chapter 27 is number 6 on your sheet, where Isaac is deceived by his wife and his son. I'm sure you're familiar with the general plot of chapter 27, but the outcome is that Isaac promises a blessing on Jacob, pronounces a blessing on Jacob, thinking he's blessing Esau. And the blessing which he gives to Jacob really is the one that belongs to Jacob. But to back up a minute, it appears that what Isaac tries to do here is to act in contradiction to God's previously revealed will when he decides to bless Esau. You see, in the early part of the chapter, he calls Esau and tells him, verse 4 of chapter 27, make me savory food, such as I love. Bring it to me, that I may eat, that my soul may bless thee before I die. Rebekah hears that. And verse 7 says, he continues to Esau, well, this is really Rebekah saying, I heard thy father speak unto Esau thy brother, saying, bring me venison and make me savory food that I may eat and bless thee before the Lord, before my death. Now, if you compare that with 25:23 that we read a few minutes ago, you remember at the time of the birth of Jacob and Esau, the Lord said, two nations are in thy womb, two manner of people will be born of thee. The one people shall be stronger. The elder shall serve the younger. And it appears that Isaac was really not prepared to accept that. Because the blessing that he gives to Jacob, thinking he's giving it to Esau, is the reverse of that. You see in 27:29, let people serve thee, nations bow down to thee, be Lord over thy brethren. But in any case, Rebekah overhears Isaac's intent to bless Esau, and she instigates then this plan of deception. And speaks to Jacob and says to him, verse 8, now therefore, my son, obey my voice. Go to the flock, fetch me from there two kids of the goats, and I will make them savory food for thy father, such as he loveth, and thou shalt bring it to thy father that he may eat, that he may bless thee before his death. And Jacob isn't so sure about all this. He says his father may feel him, verse 12, and I will seem to him as a deceiver. I shall bring a curse upon me, not a blessing, because his brother was hairy and he was smooth. And the mother says, the curse be on me, obey my voice. And she puts skins of kids' goats on his hands and the back of his neck, and makes a savory food. And he goes into Jacob, representing himself as Esau. Now, H.L. Ellison, in a book, I didn't put it on your bibliography, but a book entitled Fathers of the Covenant, says, Rebekah and Jacob planned how to accomplish God's will, holding, as they obviously did, the popular maxim, God helps those who help themselves. I think the question is, was this a proper procedure? Leupold, in his commentary, speaks of the inadequacy of faith that builds on human ingenuity. The inadequacy of faith that builds on human ingenuity. I don't think you can really justify the actions of Rebekah and Jacob, in spite of the fact that God had said the blessing should come to Jacob. They shouldn't have deceived Isaac. And of course, Isaac should not have attempted to thwart the divinely revealed will for the relationship between the two sons. Both sides, it seems to me, are at fault. And undoubtedly, favoritism played a part. If you look at 25:28, you read, Isaac loved Esau because he did eat of his venison, but Rebekah loved Jacob. So, you know, the father favored the one son, the mother favored the other son. The father wants to bless Esau. Rebekah is watching out for the interests of Jacob. Undoubtedly, that played a role in it. But I think the thing to notice, in spite of that, is that in the midst of sinful human actions, God overrules and accomplishes his will. So the end result is that the blessing that was intended for Jacob goes to Jacob. It's not that God endorses the action, but in spite of human sinful actions, God overrules and accomplishes his purpose. So Isaac thinks he's giving the blessing to Esau, but it contains God's will for Jacob. And that blessing is in verse 28 and 29 of chapter 27, where Isaac says, God give thee of the dew of heaven and of the fatness of the earth and plenty of grain and wine. Let people serve thee and nations bow down to thee. Be Lord over thy brethren. Let thy mother's sons bow down to thee. Cursed be everyone that curseth thee. Blessed be he that blesseth thee. So that blessing is placed on Jacob, although he thinks it's on Esau. Notice it concludes with the repetition of the promise, one of the promises of God to Abraham. Blessed be he that blesseth thee. Cursed be everyone that curseth thee. Well, Isaac is very disturbed when he finds out what has happened. You read in verse 33, Isaac trembled very exceedingly and said, who? Where is he that hath taken venison and brought it me? And I have eaten of all before thou camest and have blessed him. yea, and he shall be blessed. Well, this was after Esau came in. Isaac realized what had happened. Now, Ellison, in that same book, The Fathers of the Covenant, makes this statement at this point of verse 33. He says, this is the clue to much in the story. However much we may criticize Isaac, he remains one of the heroes of faith. There must have been many moments when he wondered whether his wife was not right after all. Now suddenly he knew. He had no doubt that it was Jacob who had come to him. And he bowed to God's will. Not all Esau's tears could move him, though he spoke of Jacob's guile, verse 35. There's no evidence that he ever reproved him, or Rebekah either, and he was prepared to bless him again, knowingly and willingly. And he does that at the beginning of chapter 28, when Jacob leaves home to go to Laban's house in Mesopotamia. Now, of course, with Esau, the situation is different. Esau is furious when he discovers what has happened. You read in verse 34, when Esau heard the words of his father, he cried with a great and exceedingly bitter cry and said unto his father, bless me, even me also, my father. Father says, thy brother came with subtlety and hath taken away thy blessing. At the end of verse 36, he says, hast thou not reserved a blessing for me? And Isaac answered and said unto Esau, behold, I have made him thy lord, and all his brethren have I given to him for servants, and with grain and wine have I sustained him. What shall I now do unto thee, my son? And Esau said unto his father, hast thou but one blessing, my father? Bless me, even me also, O my father. Esau lifted up his voice and wept. And Isaac, his father, answered and said unto him, and in verse 39 and 40 then, you get the, and I'll say it in quotes, you get the blessing that's given to Esau. There's a translation issue there that is of some significance because it puts it very different understanding on what is going on there. And you can see the difference in the King James and the NIV translation. If you compare verse 28 with verse 39, 28 is the blessing Isaac gives to Jacob, thinking it's Esau. 39 is the blessing he gives later to Esau, blessing in quotes. If you read them, they're very much the same. Particularly if you read it in the King James. See, in the King James it says, behold, thy dwelling shall be in the fatness of the earth and of the dew of heaven from above. And by thy sword shalt thou live, thou shalt serve thy brother, and it shall come to pass when thou shalt have dominion, thou shalt break his yoke from off thy neck. Now, the phrases are the same. The dew of heaven, and the dew of heaven, fatness of the earth, fatness of the earth. They're just reversed in order. In 28, therefore God give thee of the dew of heaven and the fatness of the earth. In 39, thy dwelling shall be of the fatness of the earth and of the dew of heaven. Reverses the two phrases. This should be 28. No. This should be 27, not 28. Okay. 27, 39. But the point of difference turns on the translation of this preposition. In the Hebrew, that's a min preposition. And the question is whether that min is to be understood as a min of source or a min of separation. If you understand it as a min of source in both cases, then the blessing that's given there to Esau is basically identical with the one that previously had been given to Jacob. If you take it as a min of separation, then what you're saying is like the NIV says, your dwelling will be away from earth's richness, away from the dew of heaven. In other words, not really a blessing, it's more of a curse. Your dwelling's going to be away from earth's richness. And of course, that's exactly what was the case with Esau, because Esau becomes Edom. Edom dwelt in that wilderness, way to the south of the Dead Sea. It's a barren place. It was away from earth's richness, away from the dew of heaven. And I think what Jacob does, you see, he gives the same blessing in that first verse, in a sense. But there's an ambiguity to it, based on the use of this preposition. And the intent, as far as meaning is concerned, I think was the opposite of what it was with Jacob. And then it goes on, of course, in verse 40, and says, "By thy sword thou shalt live, thou shalt serve thy brother. And it shall come to pass, when you shall have the dominion, that thou shalt break his yoke from off thy neck." What you get some hint of here is the subsequent history of the relationship between Israel and Edom. That is, the descendants of Jacob and the descendants of Esau. And at various times, the Edomites were subjected to Israel. David subjected the Edomites initially and put fortresses in their territory. And that fluctuated back and forth. At times they were able to throw Israel's yoke off, but then they were resubjected again. And that really went on all the way into the intertestament period, when the Edomites eventually were pushed out of their own territory, way to the south there, came up and settled in southern Judea, and were forcibly Judaized by the Maccabees. That is, they were made to circumcise, follow the law of Moses, and so forth. So they were forcibly Judaized. They became known as Edomians, from the Greek of Edom. And it's out of that stock that Herod the Great came on the scene. And Herod the Great, of course, persecuted the Jews. So you get this struggle between the Edomites and the Israelites, Jacob and Esau, stretching all through the subsequent history in the Old Testament, through the intertestament period, on to Herod the Great. I don't know. Of course, the wording is the same. They just were consistent, but
it's
the
antithesis there,
the
very nature of the
situation.
Yeah.
What's the? Who has an NASB?
It reflects the same as the NIV.
Away from.
I'm just wondering whether the first part of the Latin word is identical to the second part.
Well, you certainly could read it that way grammatically, you know, it's according to the vocabulary and the syntax, because it basically is the same. But it doesn't fit history. Now, the Edomites did not dwell in the fatness of the earth with the dew of heaven.
But in the market, they translated off also, whereas in the text, it's just away from.
Yeah, well, it can be translated either way. So, if you have a situation like that, you have to interpret it by the context. And in the context, it seems to me, when Isaac has already said, I've made him my Lord, and so forth, he couldn't go back on that.
With how I was expecting to get such a blessing. And Jacob, we are saying that he was morally wrong. But was it right for Esau to insist on the blessing, since he had already sold it to his brother, the birthright to his brother? If it was not right for Esau to demand the birthright, then what is the English called Isaac as the blessing of his brother, and there was no need for the blessing?
Well,
but can we say also that two wrongs do not make a right?
I don't think they do. In that case, I mean, that's another facet of the story, what you bring up. But what you get is a compounding of wrongs.
That's right.
And it seems to me that what we then conclude is not that any of that's justified, but in spite of, God overrules the good.
So all of them are wrong.
Okay, 7 is Isaac's death. Chapter 35, 27 to 29. Jacob came unto Isaac, his father, unto Mamre, unto the city of Arba, which is Hebron, where Abraham and Isaac sojourned. And the days of Isaac were 104 years. And Isaac died, and was gathered unto his people, being old and full of days, and his sons Esau and Jacob buried him. So, of course, this jumps ahead in the narratives of Genesis quite a ways, but we're looking at this sort of topically at this point, under the life of Isaac, and his death then is recorded in chapter 35. All right, let's move on to F, which is Jacob. First, Jacob at Bethel. We'll go back and pick up right after this incident of the deception of Isaac. Chapter 28 tells us that Jacob left home. After his deception of Isaac. You find in chapter 27 as background for this, verse 41, Esau hated Jacob because of the blessing. And Esau said in his heart, "The days of the mourning of my father are at hand, then I will slay my brother Jacob." And these words of Esau, her elder son, were told to Rebekah. And she sent and called Jacob, her younger son, and said to him, "Behold, thy brother Esau is touching thee, doth comfort himself, purposing to kill thee. Now therefore, my son, obey my voice, arise, flee thou to Laban, my brother, to Haran, and tarry with him a few days, until thy brother's fury turn away, till thy brother's anger turn away from thee, and he forget that which thou hast done to him. Then I will send and fetch thee from there. Why should I be deprived also of you both in one day?" The idea being, if Esau really killed Jacob, then she wouldn't have Jacob, but Esau's life would be taken as well. She'd lose both her sons. So she wants Jacob to leave and get out of that context. It's interesting then what she does in verse 46 with Isaac. She goes to Isaac, verse 46, and says, "I'm weary of my life because of the daughters of Heth. If Jacob take a wife of the daughters of Heth, such as those, these who are the daughters of the land, what good shall my life do me?" So she's really concerned for Jacob's life, but when she speaks to Isaac, she puts this other picture on the thing that she's concerned that Jacob not marry someone of the Canaanites. And so Isaac then calls Jacob at the first part of chapter 28, and tells him, "You shall not take a wife of the daughters of Canaan. But rise, go to Padan Aram, to the house of Bethuel, thy mother's father, take a wife from there of the daughters of Laban, thy mother's brothers." And then he repeats the blessing, "God Almighty bless thee, make thee fruitful, multiply thee, that thou mayest be a multitude of people, and give thee the blessing of Abraham to thee, and to thy seed with thee, that thou mayest inherit the land wherein thou art a sojourner, which God gave unto Abraham." So there he see a continuation of this line of promise. So Jacob leaves, and he goes to Haran. I already put this up, but look at it again. Remove a generation. See, here's Rebekah, whose brother was Laban. And Esau and Jacob are brothers. And Jacob goes to Laban's house and eventually marries both Leah and Rachel, who are the daughters of Laban. That's jumping ahead, of course. On the way, he stops to rest for a night at Bethel. And the Lord appears to him in a dream at Bethel. This is in verses 12 and following of chapter 28. You read, "He dreamed, and behold, a ladder set up on the earth, and the top of it reached to heaven. And behold, the angels of God ascending and descending on it. And behold, the Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord God of Abraham thy father and the God of Isaac. The land whereon thou liest, to thee will I give it, to thy seed. And thy seed shall be as the dust of the earth, and thou shalt spread abroad to the west, to the east, to the north, to the south. In thee and thy seed shall all the families of the earth be blessed. And behold, I am with thee, and will keep thee in all places to which thou goest, and will bring thee again to this land. For I will not leave thee until I have done that which I have spoken to thee of. Now at this point, in Jacob's life, the Lord had not yet personally appeared to him and reaffirmed this promise from Abraham to Isaac. Now we're moving to the third generation, to Jacob. But at this point in his life, as he is fleeing from Esau and going to seek a wife from the household of Laban, God comes to him while he sleeps. And I think the point there is, again, God takes the initiative. And he repeats the promise to Abraham that had already been repeated to Isaac. And then adds to that that he will be with him in his journey and ultimately bring him back to the land of Canaan. Now, in the dream, in verse 12, you read there was a ladder, top of it reaching to heaven, with the angels of God ascending and descending on it. It seems to me that that signifies communion between God and Jacob. The angels ascend to God with Jacob's needs. Jacob was fearful. He's fleeing for his life. And then they descend with God's grace and blessing for Jacob. That's just at least a suggestion as far as the significance of the symbolism there in a dream. When you get to the end of the chapter, after receiving that promise, he awakes. Verse 16. He says, surely the Lord is in this place. And he takes a stone and sets it up, pours oil on it. In verse 19, he calls the name of that place Bethel, which in Hebrew means house of God. And then verse 20 to 22, he makes a vow. And he says, if God will be with me and will keep me in this way that I go and will give me bread to eat and raiment to put on so that I come again to my father's house in peace, the King James says, then shall the Lord be my God. And this stone which I have set for a pillar shall be God's house. And of all that thou shalt give me, I will surely give a tenth unto thee. Now, loopholed on in the middle of page 14 on your bibliography, pages 779, 780, in his commentary on Genesis, suggests that that translation is not the best translation. Because he would put the apodosis in the conditional sentence at the beginning of verse 22 rather than at the end of verse 21. The difference that makes is this. You read 21, so that I come again to my father's house in peace, and the Lord shall be my God, then this stone which I have set for a pillar shall be God's house. With the translation of the King James, and I believe that's also the translation of the NIV and the NASB, Leupold says, if it's placed earlier, that apophysis, it would betray a cheap mercenary spirit bargaining with God. In other words, if you do this, then you're going to be my God. Whereas, if you put the apophysis beginning at verse 22, which you can do in the Hebrew, the construction would be the same. It's just a wow. It's a contextual thing, deciding which is the best way to go. It's hard to decide. He would say, so that I come again to my father's house, and the Lord is my God, then this stone which I have set shall be God's house. Now, contrary to what Leupold says, Alders, in his commentary, prefers the translation as I've read it. And he says, he feels it indicates, quote, that Jacob had not yet reached the point of unconditional commitment to God as his God. It really is a still bargaining with God. It's evidence that he's still somewhat selfish in his service of God. He has not yet fully surrendered his life to God's service. He does not reach that point until later, chapter 32, verses 24 to 30. I think that's hard to say. It's not something you can clear up with looking at the Hebrew construction. It's something that's interpreted. Is he really in this bargaining spirit? Then the Lord will be my God. You prove yourself to me, then I'll accept you as my God. I think that's possible. All right, number two is the years at Haran. Chapters 29 to 31. There are a lot of things that happen at Haran. I think the thing to emphasize, to just get the large picture, you might say, is that at Haran, the promise of the great seed is incipiently fulfilled in the birth of 11 sons. The promise of the great seed is incipiently fulfilled in the birth of 11 sons. That's what happens at Haran. Jacob goes to Haran, he marries, and 11 children are born, not all to one wife, two wives, two maidservants, but 11 children. Those 11 children become the progenitors of the tribes of Israel. So, see, that's significant. You're moving forward with this promise. The great seed is being fulfilled in the events of Haran. All right, to go back and pick up the narrative, when he arrives, he's met by his cousin Rachel and taken to Laban, his uncle. And after a month living there, he agrees to work for his uncle for 7 years in order to receive Rachel as his wife. You read in verse 17, Laban had two daughters. The name of the elder was Leah, the name of the younger was Rachel. Leah was tender-eyed, but Rachel was beautiful and well-favored. And Jacob loved Rachel and said, I will serve thee 7 years for Rachel, thy younger daughter. So that agreement is made. But when the time of the wedding feast comes, after he's worked 7 years, Laban gives Jacob Leah instead of Rachel. You find that in verse 21. And following, Jacob said unto Laban, give me my wife, for my days are fulfilled, that I may go in unto her. And Laban gathered together all the men of the place and made a feast. And it came to pass in the evening that he took Leah, his daughter, and brought her to him. And he went in unto her. And Laban gave unto his daughter Leah, Zilpah his maid, for an handmaid. And it came to pass that in the morning, behold, it was Leah. And he said to Laban, what is this thou hast done to me? Did I not serve thee for Rachel? Wherefore then hast thou beguiled me? And Laban says, it must not be so done in our country to give the younger before the firstborn. Fulfill her week, and we will give thee this also for the service which thou shalt serve me yet another 7 years. Now, I think that narrative, at least for me, is somewhat difficult to understand how that could actually happen. But remember, they were feasting and celebrating, and it says it came to pass in the evening he took Leah. They were probably veiled, the women in that day. Leah was obviously a willing partner to the scheme, and in any case, Jacob is surprised this morning. He has Leah instead of Rachel. He's given the excuse that we don't give the younger daughter before the elder. Now, of course, you would think that that should have been understood when the first arrangement was made. I think it's quite apparent that Laban here is manipulating Jacob. Jacob, you see, the irony of it, at this point, is the one who was deceived. He had previously deceived his father, Isaac, So you get in the next generation the reverse of that. But after a week of marriage celebration, he gets his second wife, a sister of the first. I don't have time really to develop that much. I'll pick up here at the beginning of the next hour. I just came across something I want to read to you. We'll stop with this. This is the last issue of the Journal of the Evangelical Theological Society. There's a review of a book here called Biblical Limericks, Old Testament Stories Reversed. And some illustrations are given. This is a book, apparently, of limericks of various situations in the Old Testament. But one of them that it gives here in this review is, Jacob worked out his full stint to win Rachel with never a hint that aught was awry, then Laban so sly said, now, booby, read the small print. I'll stop with that.
Anything, I'm not fully understanding anything about the Lord saying that the older will serve the younger. And is there anything I can do study wise to understand that more of what they did? Like, was he supposed to recognize that and obey?
I think more it's a long term thing, not so much maybe individually, as it is the nation that we're going to come in descendants.
Another thing is, should I study about birthright?
Yeah.
What's all involved in that?
There was the firstborn got a double share of inheritance. So there were special inheritance rights that came to the firstborn. In other words, they were... Not all the children of somebody were on equal footing. The firstborn was really the one that was considered to continue the line of the father and receive.
Okay, that's what I wanted to know. If that's what was the line wise, would that be in the birthright issue?
Yeah, particularly with respect to inheritance rights.
So that's when it did switch down to the younger. You start going that way.
Not following the normal order of procedure.
As we were going through that again, I was sensing the idea of that Isaac should have recognized.
Because the Lord had told him
that
before the birth, the elder was going to serve him. Although it says that the Lord said that to Rachel, you can hardly imagine that Rachel didn't share that with Isaac, because he says, the Lord said unto her, Rachel, two nations are in thy womb, two men are people, the one people shall be stronger, and the elder shall serve the younger.
Oh, yeah, there it is again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was said explicitly to Rachel, but it's hard to imagine Isaac wasn't familiar with that. And so he seemed like he deliberately said, in spite of what the Lord said about that, to tell Esau that his brother was going to serve him.
Now, there is potential for a quiz Friday, or
not?
Since we didn't have the...